I, you know, terminated your employment. I can't help how you look to other people. I can appreciate the bind you're in, and I'm letting you off the hook. Then why do I feel bad? I don't like feeling bad. Fine. If it makes you feel bad, you don't have to make the decision right now. Take your time. Whatever you want, I'll be cool with it. We can't keep going around and around like this. In that case, I gotta go back to my original proposition. How about you work off the dough I paid you up front? You can spend your time any way you want. You don't even have to itemize where you went or what you did. Your prerogative entirely. Money runs out, we'll talk just like this, and you can tell me what you found. You don't have to humor me. No, no. That's not where I'm coming from. I'm fine with this, he said. How much time have you put in so far? I have no idea. I'd have to go back and calculate. Then figure it out, and whatever time you have left, use as you see fit. We have a deal? I stared at him for a moment. I didn't like any of it, but I didn't want Diana Alvarez and Len Pretty lording it over me. I said, sure. We fumbled the conversation to a close and left the conflict with neither one of us at peace. The whole complexion of the game had changed. On the surface, it looked the same. I had the younger woman in my sights. Another half day, and I'd know where she lived, and from that, I could find out who she was. Sooner or later, she'd tip her hand. Inevitably, I'd reach a point where I'd be operating on my own dime. But so what? Even if I ended up with egg on my face, there are worse things than that. The little cynical voice in me piped up saying, oh yeah? Name one. Aloud, I said, letting the bad guys win. At 2:45, I parked just outside the entrance to Horton Ravine, angling the station wagon so the long drive up to Climping Academy was in plain view. I couldn't imagine a tow truck driver opting to remove the disabled Mercedes through the rear entrance to the ravine, but I was prepared to follow him either way. In the meantime, since I wasn't actually in Horton Ravine, I was beyond the jurisdiction of the proto-cop. He'd been nice enough on our first encounter, but I didn't want to push my luck. I shut down my engine and removed a map of California from the glove compartment. I opened the map fully and laid it across the steering wheel, hoping I looked like a tourist who'd pulled off the road to get her bearings. I turned on the radio, tuning into a station that played hit songs 24 hours a day. I listened to two Michael Jackson cuts and then Whitney Houston's Where Do Broken Hearts Go? The DJ announced she'd just knocked Billy Ocean out of the number one spot. I didn't know if this was good news or bad. At 3 o'clock, the cars began their exodus, pouring down the hill from Climping, one luxury vehicle after another. When I was in high school, I'd used public transportation. Aunt Jen had a 15-year-old Oldsmobile that she used to get back and forth to work. In those days, teenagers had no rights and no sense of entitlement. We knew we were second-class citizens, entirely at the mercy of adults. There were kids who had their own cars, but it wasn't the norm. The rest of us knew better than to bitch. I pictured this crop of youngsters, not spoiled so much as unaware of how fortunate they were. 3:30 came and went, and just when I was getting worried, a tow truck approached from my left, passed me, and headed up the hill. In my mind's eye, I could see the parking lot, which would be largely deserted by now. The damsel in distress would be easy to spot. The driver would pull up in the empty lane and get out of his truck. The girl would explain the problem while gesturing at the tires. I could picture him hunkering down to have a look, quickly realizing, as she must have, that human mischief was at the root. I'd left the two valve caps on the pavement, one sitting neatly beside each flat tire. She was bound to have spotted them, and if she'd complained about being the victim of a prank, the driver had probably brought along a portable air compressor. It would be a simple matter, then, of his inflating one tire at a time and screwing the valve caps back into place. This would take no more than 3 minutes, maybe four, taking into account the back and forth of polite conversation. I checked my watch, fired up my engine, and turned off the radio. I looked up as though cued and said, "Ah." Because there came the tow truck, turning right at the foot of the hill. The Mercedes followed. Though I knew the upscale private school drew students from all over the city, I'd assumed the girl lived somewhere in Horton Ravine. However, instead of turning left and heading into the heart of the ravine, she took a right as well. I kept my face averted, making a serious study of the map still open in front of me. She didn't know me from Adam, but on the off chance we crossed paths in the future, I didn't want her making the connection. The tow truck passed me, slowed at the intersection, and took a right. She was two car lengths behind. I was already folding up the map, which I left on the passenger seat. As soon as she'd cleared the intersection, I checked for oncoming traffic, made an illegal U-turn, and followed her. The tow truck continued on across the freeway overpass. The Mercedes moved into the right lane. The girl took the 101 on-ramp and merged with the stream of speeding cars heading south. I slowed, adjusting my speed to allow another car between us. Traffic was light, and it wasn't difficult keeping up with her. She stayed in the right-hand lane and passed the off-ramp at Little Pony Road. She got off on the Missile Street exit and kept to the left in preparation for a turn. The car between us sped on. We were both caught at the stoplight at the bottom of the ramp. I could see her adjust the rearview mirror and reapply her lipstick. When the light changed, it took her a moment to register the fact. I was patient, not wanting to call attention to myself with even a quick toot of my horn. She turned left and kept to surface streets, which meant we encountered a stop sign or a stoplight at just about every intersection. I stayed three car lengths behind her. She didn't seem aware of me. And why would she? There was no reason for her to fret about an old station wagon. I watched her shake her shoulders and bounce on the seat. She lifted her right arm, fingers snapping in time to music audible only to her. I flipped on my radio again, picking up the same pop music station I'd listened to before. I didn't recognize the female vocalist, but the girl's car dancing was perfectly synchronized with the song. She turned left on Santa Teresa Street, drove three blocks, and then turned right on Juniper Lane, which was an abbreviated half block long. 10 yards before reaching the corner, I pulled over to the curb in front of a small green stucco house that fronted on Santa Teresa Street. I shut down the engine and got out, trying to behave as though I were in no particular hurry. There were newspapers piled up on the front porch steps, and the letterbox bulged with mail. I blessed the householder for being away, and at the same time faulted him for not having someone cover the house for him while he was gone. Burglars were now at liberty to break in and help themselves to his coin collection and his wife's silverware. I cut across the yard on the diagonal, happy I didn't have to worry about witnesses. An oversized weeping willow occupied one corner of the lot. 4-foot hedges grew along the edge of the property as far as a detached two-car garage, with an apron of concrete in front sufficient to allow guest parking for two. I peered over the neatly trimmed shrubs. There were only 3 houses on the far side of Juniper Lane. The centerpiece was a 2-story mock Tudor, with a 1-story ranch-style house on the left and a 1-story board and batten cottage on the right. The Mercedes was idling at the entrance to the Tudor. As I watched, the wide wrought iron gate slid open with a screech of metal on metal, and the black Mercedes sedan turned into the drive. Through the wrought iron fence, I saw the middle of 3 garage doors rumble up. The girl pulled in, and a moment later, the gate slid shut again, squealing as it had before. I reversed my steps and returned to the car. I unearthed the pen and paper from my shoulder bag. I looked to my right and made a note of the street number on the green stucco house where I'd parked. I turned the key in the ignition, put the car in gear, and proceeded to the corner. I turned right and drove at a sedate 2 miles an hour, as was appropriate on a residential street of such short duration. As I passed, I scribbled down house numbers from the 3 houses on the left, 200, 210, and 216. On the right-hand side of the street, there were 4 houses, respectively numbered 209, 213, 215, and 221. At the end of the block, I turned right and drove to the parking garage adjacent to the public library. Chapter 17. I took a seat at my favorite table in the reference room at the public library. I plucked the Santa Teresa City Directory from the shelf, and I worked my way through, running my finger down the page. In the section I'd turned to, streets were listed alphabetically. For each street, the house numbers were arranged in an orderly progression. Opposite each number, the name and occupation of the householder was given, with the spouse's name in parentheses. In a separate section, residents were listed in alphabetical order by name, this time including a phone number as well as the address. By flipping from section to section, crisscrossing, so to speak, one could pick up more information than you'd think. In my notebook, I jotted down the names of the occupants I was interested in, including those of the mock tutor, the neighbors on either side, and the families across the street. I also looked up the owner of the green stucco house that fronted on Santa Teresa Street at the corner of Juniper Lane. This is what constitutes happiness in my life, the garnering of facts. The younger woman, Audrey's accomplice, was Georgia Prestwick. I now knew her address and her phone number, which I would probably never have occasion to use. Her husband's name was Dan. His occupation was retired. If I wanted to know what he'd done before retirement, I could track through past city directories until I caught him in the act. From a different source, I knew the Prestwicks had a daughter who was an honor roll student at Climping Academy. The owner of the green stucco house was Ned Dornan, whose wife's name was Jean. He worked for the City Planning Commission, though the directory didn't specify in what capacity. I left the library, retrieved my car, and went home. It was 4:30 by then, and my day wasn't even close to being done. I sat down at my desk. My answering machine was blinking merrily. Apparently, I had any number of messages, and I was guessing all of them were related to the article in the paper. I didn't have the patience to listen to the blah, blah, blah. I'd be hearing from people I hadn't spoken to in years, and why did I owe them an explanation? I opened my bottom drawer and hauled out the phone book. I paged through until I found the all-purpose number for the city of Santa Teresa. I punched in the number, and when the operator picked up, I asked to be connected to the city planning offices. When a woman answered in that department, I asked to speak to Mr. Dornan. She said he was out of the office and wouldn't be back until Monday, May 2nd. She offered to redirect my call. I thanked her and declined, saying I'd call again. I went up the spiral stairs and cleared the top of the footlocker I use as a bedside table, setting the reading lamp, the alarm clock, and a stack of books on the floor. I lifted the lid, took out my 35mm single-lens reflex camera, inserted fresh batteries, and set it aside along with two rolls of film. Then I closed the lid and rearranged the items, pausing to dust the top with a sock I'd pulled out of the clothes hamper. I was, I confess, flying by the seat of my pants. But I had reasonable hopes of zeroing in on the woman who'd aided and abetted Audrey's shoplifting jaunt. There was no way I could risk a face-to-face encounter. While she'd shown no sign of recognizing me when we passed each other in the Nordstrom's ladies' lounge, she had most certainly known who I was in the moment when she tried to run me down. If I wanted to find out how she operated, I'd better be prepared to wait. I went out to the Mustang, a 1970 Grabber Blue Speed Monster that I'd bought to replace the VW I'd driven for years. I'll admit the car was a mistake. It was too conspicuous, and it netted me the sort of attention ill-favored by those in my line of work. I was more than ready to offload the beast if a decent offer came along. I unlocked the door on the passenger side, opened the glove compartment, and removed my binoculars. I also hauled my briefcase from the back seat and checked to make sure my Heckler and Koch was still present and accounted for, along with an ample supply of ammunition. I didn't intend to shoot anyone, but I felt more secure knowing the weapon was close at hand. I moved both briefcase and gun to my trunk, which I locked. A wise decision, as it turned out. I carried the binoculars to Henry's station wagon and set them on the floor near the driver's seat. In the back seat, I found the folded windshield screen Henry used to deflect the hot sun during protracted parking stints. Some weeks before, he'd cut holes in the cardboard so I could spy on a nasty customer I'd met on an earlier case. I put the cardboard screen on the floor on the passenger side. Back in my studio, I sat down at my desk again and punched in the phone number for the green stucco house. The phone rang 5 times, and then the machine picked up. A mechanical voice said, "No one is here to receive your call. Please try again at a later time. Thank you." Ned and Jean were apparently on vacation. Humming, I made myself a peanut butter and pickle sandwich, which I cut on the diagonal, wrapped in waxed paper, and placed in a brown paper bag. I took a wash rag from the linen closet, wet it, and squeezed most of the moisture out, tucked it into a Ziploc storage bag that I placed in my shoulder bag. This was so I could tidy up after I ate. I'm ever so dainty when I'm out in the field. I was thrilled to discover that the Fritos I tucked in there earlier were more or less intact. I filled a thermos with hot coffee and set that beside my brown bag lunch. I found my clipboard and tucked a legal pad under the clip. Then I added 2 paperbacks, my denim jacket, my camera and film, a baseball cap, and a dark long-sleeve shirt to the pile. This was as much trouble as leaving town for a week. I made a pit stop, knowing it might be hours before I'd have another opportunity. On the way back to Juniper Lane, I stopped at the market and picked up a bag of Pepperidge Farm cookies, Milano's being essential for surveillance work. Without them, I'd just end up feeling sorry for myself. I parked on Santa Teresa Street, donned my baseball cap, locked the car, and did a quick survey of the neighborhood. I walked the long block northwest along Santa Teresa until it dead-ended into Orchard Road. Around that corner and 2 blocks to the left, Orchard intersected State Street. Where I stood, the street made a sweeping bend to the right, hugging the walled boundaries of a convent. By following the curve on foot, I reached the far end of Juniper Lane. I was looking for a spot that would allow me to keep the tutor in my visual field without generating curiosity about my presence. The same strictures applied here as they had in Horton Ravine. Anyone sitting in a parked car for more than a few minutes generates uncomfortable questions. I walked along Juniper Lane, paying particular attention to the parking area provided by the absentee owner of the green stucco house. To the left of the garage, he carved out a space wide enough to accommodate a pickup truck or a recreational vehicle, neither of which were there. Instead, I was looking at a U of chicken wire fence laden with morning glory vines. I returned to my car, fired it up, and took a right at Santa Teresa Street, which I followed as far as Juniper Lane, turning right as I had a short time earlier. The question I asked myself was this: what would happen if I backed into this perfect spot and the owner returned? It seemed unlikely. As nearly as I could ascertain, the Dornans were out of town. He wasn't due at work until Monday, which didn't rule out the possibility that he'd show up early in order to enjoy a weekend at home. If so, how would I explain myself? Clueless, I had no idea. I pulled forward a good 6 feet beyond the spot and proceeded to back in, a maneuver that took a bit of doing since the station wagon felt like a boat and I wasn't familiar with the turning radius. I pulled forward again, lining myself up properly, then eased backward as far as the fence, which shivered when my rear bumper made contact. I rolled down the window and then shut off the engine. I popped open the windshield screen and slid it into place. I was now sheltered between the fence on my right and the garage on my left. The cardboard screen cut the daylight by half, creating quite the cozy effect. I leaned forward over the steering wheel and peered through the holes in the cardboard at the Tudor across the way. The electrified wrought iron gate was no more than 50 feet in front of me. I could see the entire facade of the house and a portion of the 3-car garage. If Georgia Prestwick emerged in her Mercedes or in any other vehicle, I'd not only have a clear view, I'd be in position to follow if she turned in either direction. I checked my watch. It was 5:45. I picked up my clipboard and made a note of the time, which made me believe I was doing something worthwhile instead of wasting my time. I'd brought along my index cards, and I studied them as though preparing for a test. A week had passed since Audrey was arrested, jailed, and released on bail. If she were alive and kept to her routine, tomorrow would have been her Saturday in San Luis Obispo, doing whatever she did in that house with the crew that was ferried in by van. They had to have been clipping tags from stolen merchandise, maybe sorting and packing items for redistribution. Why else would so many people assemble and disassemble every other week? The system was probably designed so that Audrey's death or the loss of any of the intermediaries wouldn't cripple the operation. There had to be a backup plan in place, at least until someone could be found to fill her shoes and a new hierarchy could be established. Audrey and Georgia had worked as a team, and there were doubtless other sticky-fingered pairs also making the rounds. Somewhere along the line, there had to be a fence, as well as someone in charge of moving the goods. If I remembered correctly from my days in uniform and from what Maria said, certain items like infant formula, beauty products, smoking cessation patches, and diet supplements would be shipped overseas to countries willing to pay inflated prices for such goods. Other items would be sold at swap meets and flea markets. I wondered what Georgia would be doing now that Audrey was out of the picture. I didn't believe the van would arrive at Audrey's this week as it had in the past. The house had been stripped and sanitized. All the fingerprints had been wiped clean, and I assumed Vivian Hewitt had changed the locks, which would put the place out of commission any which way you looked at it. A new location had probably been set up, so the job could go on as before. I finished my Fritos and ate a cookie to keep up my strength. 20 minutes later, I poured myself some coffee from my thermos. I figured once it got dark, if my bladder required relief, I could slip out of the car, proceed to the vine-covered fence at the rear, and squat. In the meantime, I didn't dare turn on the radio or do anything else that might call attention to my hidey hole. I picked up the first of the two paperback novels and read through the acknowledgments, hoping to come across the name of someone I knew. This was a first novel, and the writer thanked 100 people individually and profusely. I was already worried this was as good as the book was going to get. Ordinarily, I'd have been thrilled with having the time to read, but I felt jumpy and tense. I set the paperback aside and ate my sandwich, well aware that I was running through my food supplies at too quick a pace. I took out my wet wash rag and wiped my hands. It wasn't even dark, and I had hours to go. My plan was to follow Georgia if she left the house in the next 5 hours. If there was no activity, I'd wait until the house was dark and everyone was tucked in for the night, and then I'd go home for a few hours' sleep. I picked up my book again and turned to page 1. I didn't realize I'd fallen asleep until a police officer tapped on my car window with his flashlight, which jump-started my heart and nearly made me wet my pants. The cardboard screen was still in place, blocking my windshield, so I couldn't actually see out. I could hear the sound of a car idling, and I assumed it was his patrol car. Around the edges of the cardboard screen, I could see flashes of red and blue, a Morse code of dots and dashes that spelled out, "You are so screwed." I glanced at my watch and saw that it was just past midnight and pitch black outside. Except for the flashing lights, of course, which would probably alert everyone in the neighborhood that some kind of trouble was going down. I turned the key one notch in the ignition and lowered the window, saying, "Hi, how are you? You're parked on private property. Are you aware of it?" My mind was blank. How could I not be aware of it? I didn't live here. I flashed on my alternatives, telling lies, fibbing, making stuff up, or telling the truth, and decided on the latter. Under the circumstances, lying was only going to make life more complicated, and I didn't want to risk it. I'm a private investigator, and I'm running a surveillance on the woman who lives in the house across the street. He remained expressionless and kept his tone neutral. Have you had anything to drink in the past 2 hours? No, sir. No wine, beer, cocktails of any kind? Honestly, I put my hand over my heart as though reciting the Pledge of Allegiance. Unconvinced, he held up his flashlight, directing the beam into the back seat and the front, ostensibly looking for empty wine, beer, or whiskey bottles, weapons, illicit substances, or other evidence of bad behavior. I knew for a fact the flashlight was equipped to pick up traces of alcohol. Good luck to him. I had no outstanding wants or warrants, and if he insisted on a breathalyzer test, I was going to blow a zero, which he must have realized when his tricky flashlight failed to detect even one particle of ethanol per gazillion. If he put me through a field sobriety test, I'd pass with flying colors, unless he asked me to recite the alphabet backward. I'd been meaning to practice that, just in case, but so far I haven't gotten around to it. Ma'am, I'm going to have to ask you to step out of the car. I released the power locks and opened the car door. There was a second officer standing in the street beside the patrol car, radio to his mouth, probably calling in the license plate number. Aside from my occasional, very minor violations of the law, I consider myself a model citizen, easily intimidated by police officers when I know I'm in the wrong. I was guilty of trespassing, and also in violation of municipal codes unknown to me but very well known to the police. I was glad I hadn't added public urination to my list of sins. I was also glad I didn't have my handgun in my briefcase anywhere within range. Once I was out of the car, the officer said, "Would you turn around and face forward, put your hands out, and lean against the car?" He couldn't have been more polite. I did as instructed and was subjected to a brisk but thoroughly professional pat-down. I wanted to volunteer the fact that I had no weapon, but I knew that would sound suspicious when he was already on red alert. Stops like this can turn deadly without warning or provocation. For all he knew, I was a parolee in violation of section such and such. I might have been a fugitive with a felony warrant out against me. May I see your license and registration? I have to reach into the glove compartment. Is that all right? My wallet's in my shoulder bag. He gestured his assent. This was the second time in 24 hours I'd been asked to provide identification. I slid into the driver's seat and reached across to the glove compartment. Henry was meticulous about things of this sort, so I knew I could lay hands on the current paperwork, including proof of insurance. I found both and offered them to the officer. "The car belongs to my landlord," I said. "He's out of town and said I could drive the car in his absence to keep the battery from going dead." I didn't like talking to him from a seated position, but I wasn't keen to exit the car again unless instructed to do so. Here are some handy little tips for those of you who don't want to fall victim to deadly officer shootings. Do as you're told. Don't talk back. Don't be rude or belligerent. Don't try to escape. Don't get back in your car and try to run over the nice officer performing the traffic stop. If you should be so foolhardy as to attempt any of the above, don't complain later of your injuries and do not file suit. I wanted to make sure he was watching me extract my wallet from my bag, so he wouldn't think I was about to pull out a little two-shot Derringer. I removed my driver's license and a photocopy of my private investigator's license from my wallet and handed them to the officer. He read the information on both and gave me a look, which I took as a form of encouragement, all of us law enforcement types being in this together. His name tag said P. Martinez, though he didn't appear to be Hispanic. I wondered if wondering if he was Hispanic was a form of racism, but I thought not. He walked over to the patrol car and conferred with the other officer. I took advantage of his absence to get out of the car again. The two walked back in my direction. Of course, there were no introductions. P. Martinez was tall and a bit on the hefty side, mid-40s, fully decked out in all the regulation paraphernalia, badge, belt, holstered gun, nightstick, flashlight, keys, radio. He was a one-man army prepared for just about anything. His partner, D. Charpentier, appeared to be in his 50s and similarly arrayed with an arsenal of crime-stopping gear. On a guy, there's something sexy about all that shit. On a female officer, it only creates the illusion of being overweight. It's amazing to me that any woman would volunteer for such a look. Officer Martinez said, "Want to tell him what you just told me? The long version or the short?" "Take your time," he said. "I'm running a surveillance on the woman across the street. Her name is Georgia Prestwick. Last Friday, I was a witness to a shoplifting incident at Nordstrom's that involved a woman named Audrey Vance, who's since gone off the Cold Spring Bridge. All of this must have come up at one of your briefings." I looked for a spark of recognition at the mention of Audrey's name, but both were too professional to display facial feedback. At least, I had their full attention. Audrey was taken into custody, though I'm sorry to say I don't know the name of the arresting officer. Georgia Prestwick was working with Audrey Vance, and she took advantage of the diversion to exit the store. I went after her, and when she realized I was following her, she tried to run me down. All of this sounded preposterous in summary, but I'd launched into the account, and I thought I'd best continue. Officer Charpentier still had my driver's license and copy of my PI license, and he seemed to make a study of both while I went on in this vein, dropping Maria Gutierrez's name into the mix in case either gentleman was acquainted with her. Winding up, I said, "At any rate, I think Miss Prestwick is tied to a larger organization. I hope you're not going to tell me she's the one who called 911. The two officers exchanged a covert look, and I knew right then they'd read the article in the paper in which Diana Alvarez had bandied my name about. I may not have been drinking, but they had it on good authority that their fellow officer, Len Pretty, thought I was a crackpot. Officer Martinez returned my two licenses. "No one called. We've been coming by twice a day doing house checks for the property owner while he's out of town. My partner's the one who spotted you. Technically, we could cite you on a trespass, but we're going to let that one go as long as you move on." "Thank you. I appreciate it." I glanced at the facade of the Tudor across the street. There were no lights visible, but that didn't mean someone wasn't looking out an upstairs window, attracted by the flash of police lights that were lighting up the night like a mortar attack. It was going to look better anyway if I left as I'd been asked to do. If the Prestwicks were peeking out, let them think I was drunk or a vagrant living in my car. That's what our police presence is supposed to do, make our neighborhood safe from the likes of me. I got into my car. I removed the cardboard screen from the windshield and tossed it in the back seat. The two officers returned to their unit and got in, their two car doors slamming in quick succession. They waited until I pulled out and then followed me for a good 8 blocks, assuring themselves that I wouldn't circle back and park where I had before. When they turned off, I waved and drove home. I couldn't believe cops were so distrustful. Chapter 18. Nora. Channing arrived in Montebello Saturday afternoon. He'd called from Malibu, ostensibly to let her know he was on his way. She suspected his true intention was to test the waters on the home front, angling to see if his cover had been blown. She'd made a point of being pleasant on the phone, playing the conversation at exactly the right pitch, her manner easy and light. Certainly, there was none of the tension and fury he must have anticipated. As the exchange went on, she could hear him relax, relief seeping into his tone. She glossed over the particulars of how she'd spent her Wednesday afternoon, laying in just enough detail to make it convincing. She knew how anxious he'd be to avoid discovery. His feelings for Thelma were running high, and he'd be determined to hold on to her. Eventually, he'd tire of her, but for now his affair provided all the thrills and suspense of a spy novel. Nora heard his tires crunching in the gravel courtyard. She went downstairs, breathing deeply, like an actress getting into her role. Wednesday night was accounted for. The symphony had run 90 minutes. Afterwards, she and Belinda and Nan had a bite to eat at a bistro across the street. Nora had picked up the check so Channing could see it for himself when the visa bill came in. Lest he harbor any doubt, she'd tossed her concert program on the kitchen counter as though by oversight. Now all she had to do was explain the missing clothes. Channing came into the kitchen from the garage where he'd parked his car. He'd stopped at the mailbox and picked up the day's delivery, so he was already separating the magazines from the catalogs. He put both stacks on the kitchen counter and glanced at the program in passing.
Mahler's Sixth. I didn't know you were a fan.
Nora smiled as she lifted her face so he could kiss her cheek. Nan's idea. She read a biography that suggested he stole the melodic line from a piano duet by Weber. There was also this whole big brouhaha about whether the scherzo should precede or follow the andante. I know it sounds tedious, but it was fun knowing what went on behind the scenes.
I'm glad you enjoyed it.
I did. Very much so. Sissy and Jess were there, but I didn't have a chance to talk to either one of them. What about you? How was your evening?
I changed my mind about going. When it came right down to it, I wasn't in the mood.
Really? You seem so set on being there.
I had a hard day at work, and I couldn't bear the idea of getting into a tux. On the way home, I stopped at Tony's and picked up an order of ribs.
Bad boy.
If I'd known you were going to play hooky, I'd have made a point of joining you.
What happened to your table for 10?
I guess there were 2 empty seats instead of 1.
She smiled. Oh, well. The money went for a good cause, so I suppose it doesn't matter.
We have something on for tonight?
Dinner with the Hellers at 9 Palms.
What time?
6:30 for drinks. Dinner reservations at 7, but Mitchell said he'd seat us whenever we were ready.
Good. Sounds like fun.
Nora took the tea kettle from the stove and carried it to the sink, filling it from the filtered water tap. Did you notice all my formal wear was gone? She could see the caution rise in him.
I just got here.
Not here, Malibu. He opened a piece of mail and glanced at the contents.
Went right by me, he said. What's the story?
I had Mrs. Stumbo drive down Wednesday and bring everything back. I would have called to tell you, but I talked to you once and I didn't want to bother you again.
You're not a bother when you call.
Thank you. That's sweet. But I don't like being a pest when it's not important. At any rate, when I realized I wouldn't be coming down last week, I asked her to take care of it. She dropped the whole carload at the cleaners, so at least that's out of the way.
I don't understand. Did I miss something here?
Spring cleaning. A closet purge. I've had some of those gowns for years, and half of them don't fit. I'll keep the best ones, and any I don't want, I'll donate to the Fashion Institute. She put the kettle on the stove and turned on the burner. Would you like a cup of tea?
I'm fine. What if an occasion comes up?
I guess I'll just have to go shopping.
You know what a chore that is, she said, smiling. Might require a trip to New York, he said, matching her tone.
Exactly. Dinner at the club was pleasant. The place had an old-fashioned, fusty air about it, like the home of a rich maiden aunt. The once grand furniture was upholstered in a peach brocade that had seen better days. The couches and chairs were arranged in conversational groupings. Some of the cushions were lumpy and the arms were frayed in places, but an upgrade would require a membership assessment, which would set off endless disagreements and endless complaints. The club was largely given over to couples in their 70s and 80s, whose homes had appreciated in value while their retirement income had dwindled, subject to the whims of the economy. The so-called younger members were in their 50s and 60s, better off financially, perhaps, but destined for the same fate. Old friends would start dropping off one by one, and in the end, they'd be grateful to spend an evening with the few tottering acquaintances who were left. Robert and Gretchen were their usual 10 minutes late. The delay was so consistent,
She wondered why they couldn't manage to be on time. The four of them hadn't seen one another since the Christmas holidays, so they caught up over drinks. Their relationship was amicable but superficial. All four were ardent Republicans, which meant any talk of politics was quickly addressed as they were all in agreement. Nora had met the Hellers in Los Angeles shortly before she and Channing were married. Robert was a plastic surgeon who'd been felled by a heart attack 10 years earlier. He was 52 at the time, and from that point on had cut his practice back to 2 days a week. Gretchen was his first and only wife, also in her early 60s, but with the years artfully erased. She had big green eyes, white blonde hair, and flawless skin. Her boobs were fake, but not conspicuously so. The Hellers were the first to buy in Montebello, a 6,000-square-foot French Normandy house at Nine Palms, which, in addition to the golf course, offered one-acre parcels in a gated community with like-minded souls. Robert was a dumpling of a man, half a head shorter than Gretchen, bald and apple-shaped. The two so plainly adored each other that Nora was often envious. Tonight, she was especially grateful for their company, because it kept the flow of conversation light and inconsequential. Nora managed to remain gracious while keeping her distance from her husband. At moments, she saw his gaze settle on her quizzically, as though he sensed the difference in her without being able to put his finger on it. She knew he wouldn't ask for fear she'd tell him something he didn't want to know. They moved from drinks in the parlor to the dining room, where they ordered their second round of drinks, menus open in front of them. There was a set selection of entrees at surprisingly reasonable prices. Where else could you order Salisbury steak or beef stroganoff for $7.95 with a salad and two sides? These were foods from the 1950s, nothing trendy, spicy, or ethnic. Nora was debating between the pan-seared petrolli sole and the roast chicken and mashed potatoes when Gretchen leaned toward Robert and placed a hand on his sleeve. "Oh, my God. You won't believe who just walked in." Nora was sitting with her back to the entrance, so she had no idea who Gretchen was referring to. Robert glanced discreetly to the side and said, "Shit." Two men passed the table in the wake of the maitre d' who was leading the way. The first, Nora knew by sight, though she didn't remember his name. The second was Lorenzo Dante. She dropped her gaze, feeling the warmth rise to her cheeks. Despite his claim he might be there, he was the last person in the world she had actually expected to see at Nine Palms. She'd put the meeting with him out of her mind, refusing to think about the awkward transaction with the ring. She'd returned the ring to her jewelry box, wishing she hadn't been so adamant in her refusal of the $75,000. She should have taken it. Nora leaned forward. "Who is he?" Under her breath, Gretchen said, "Lorenzo Dante's son. They call him Dante." Then she mouthed, "He's mafia." Robert picked up on the comment and responded with impatience, "Good God, Gretchen, he's not mafia. Where did you get that idea?"
"The equivalent," she said. "You told me so yourself."
"I did no such thing. I said I did business with him once upon a time. I said he was a tough customer."
"You said worse than that, and you know it," she replied.
The maitre d' seated the two men at a corner table, and Nora found Dante facing her, visible just over Channing's shoulder. The juxtaposition was an odd one, Channing's slim elegance in contrast to Dante's more substantial build. Channing's hair was white, clipped close on the sides with a short ruff on top. His brows were almost invisible, and his face was narrow. Dante was silver-haired, and his complexion was a warmer tone. Dark brows, gray mustache, deeply dimpled cheeks. With his features lined up against Channing's, she could see how pinched her husband looked. Maybe the strain of his secret life was taking its toll. Nora had always thought Channing was good-looking, but she wondered about that now. His face was drained of color, and he looked like he'd lost weight. The waiter appeared at the table, and they ordered their meal and a bottle of Kistler Chardonnay. She felt herself detach, a state that was becoming all too frequent with her of late. Whatever Robert's business with Dante, he clearly didn't want to talk about it now. Gretchen would have enlightened her, given half a chance. In their social set, gossip was a sport. There was no fact of the matter, only rumor and innuendo. Points were awarded for anything juicy, regardless of the truth content. This was what she knew of Dante, that he'd come to her defense. This was what she also knew, that he'd offered her a way out. She tuned into Robert's conversation with Channing and heard him propose lunch and a round of golf. "You have a tea time? Don't need one on Sundays. The course won't be crowded. We can walk on any time we like." Channing caught Nora's eye. "Is that okay with you?"
"Fine."
The talk shifted to Robert's last round of golf. He played Pebble Beach the weekend before, and the two men discussed the course. Neither she nor Gretchen played golf, which meant the two men could hold forth while nothing was expected of them. The salads arrived, and the topic of conversation shifted again. This time to the cruise to the Far East the Hellers were taking at the end of June. They compared notes about cruise lines, and Nora was able to keep up her end of the conversation without effort. Once she disconnected, everything was so much easier. Channing poured her another glass of wine. He smiled when their eyes met, but there was no emotional content. She missed the early days of their romance. Thelma was now the recipient of all that she had cherished in him. If she were honest about it, she'd acknowledge how little of herself she'd given Channing in the past few years. The disconnect wasn't the direct result of his affair. It was habitual to her. The Petrale sole turned out to be a mistake. White and flavorless, lying in a pool of butter. Nora picked her way through the meal, and in the lull between the entree and dessert, she excused herself and headed for the ladies' lounge. She went about her business, ran a comb through her hair, reapplied her lipstick. She'd felt so clever disguising her feelings from Channing, making sure he had no inkling of where she was or what she knew. But in pretending not to care, she'd actually ceased to care. Reviving her old feelings for him seemed to be out of her control. As she emerged from the ladies' lounge, she saw Dante coming down the corridor. She felt a jolt, tension or apprehension, she wasn't sure which. He wore a pale gray suit and a dark gray dress shirt with a black tie. The combination gave him the look of a gangster, which he was either unaware of or didn't care to hide. She knew he'd timed his leaving the table to coincide with her return. She said, "What are you doing here?" Somehow the question seemed accusatory, which wasn't her intent. "I told you I'd be here. I'm having dinner with a friend."
"I thought you were just making conversation."
"I was. You left the office. I decided I'd better have a look at the guy lucky enough to be married to you. I don't think he appreciates what he has." She dropped her gaze.
"I have to get back."
"Why don't you have a drink with me tomorrow, just the two of us?"
"I don't drink."
"You had wine with dinner."
"We should talk."
"About what?"
"How you ended up married to a bum."
"He's not a bum."
"Yes, he is.
You just haven't seen it yet. I know his type. He looks good on the surface, but underneath, he's a royal shit."
Nora felt the heat rise in her cheeks. "My friend says you're mafia."
He smiled. "Flattering, but false. I'm connected in other ways."
"You're a thug."
He smiled. "Now you've got it. I'm a bona fide badass," he said. "Give me an hour of your time tomorrow. That's not too much to ask."
"I can't."
"There's a place on State Street called Down the Hatch. You can look it up in the phone book. It's a dive. You won't see anyone you know."
"Channing and I have plans."
"So? Cancel them. 1 o'clock. The place will be deserted."
"Why would I agree?"
I want to sit someplace quiet and dark so I can look at you. That's not a good idea. I'd say lunch, but then you'd think it was a date. And that, I know, you'd refuse.
No, thank you.
Think about it. She started to protest, and he put a finger on her lips. His touch was brief, but startlingly intimate.
Excuse me, she said, and moved away.
When Nora returned to the table, Channing was talking about leg hold traps. She was confused that such a subject had come up. As she took her seat, she said, "Leg hold traps? Where did that come from?" Gretchen said, "Your gardener's complaining about the coyotes." Nora realized Mr. Ishiguro had told Channing about the coyote scat he'd showed her Wednesday when she was at the house. Since she'd told him she'd sent Mrs. Stumbo, she had to play dumb. Even if Mr. Ishiguro had mentioned her being there, his English was so fractured that Channing wouldn't get the reference. "What about the coyotes?" she asked. Channing's gesture was impatient. "They've invaded the property. They're crapping everywhere. Mr. Ishiguro says he's seen the male leap that 6-foot wall between us and the Fergusons. Karen's 2 cats disappeared this past week. I told you about that."
"She shouldn't have left them out. You said yourself how irresponsible it was."
"You're missing the point. They're getting bolder by the minute. Once they lose their fear of humans, they're really dangerous. Mr. Ishiguro suggested traps, and I said fine."
"Why would you let him use leg hold traps? Those are horrible. They can snap an animal's leg in 2. If the poor things don't bleed to death, they're in excruciating pain. Why would you agree to something so barbaric?
Those coyotes have never bothered us. They're predators. They'll eat anything, birds, garbage, carrion, you name it."
Gretchen said, "I'll tell you something gruesome. A friend of ours had her little Shih Tzu dragged off and eviscerated. She was standing right there, the poor dog, all bloody and screaming. She said it was the worst thing that's ever happened to her. She went out and bought a shotgun, and she keeps it by the back door. She won't go out in the yard now unless she's armed."
"That's ridiculous," Nora said.
Gretchen said, "I beg to differ. Even where we are, you can hear them howling after dark. Sounds like a pack of wild Indians about to attack. It gives me the willies."
"I better keep my pistol loaded," Channing said with a smile. "If the traps don't work, I can pick them off from the deck."
"You have a pistol?" Gretchen asked.
"Of course."
"Well, aren't you the wily one? I had no idea."
"Stop it," Nora snapped. "If that man sets leg hold traps, I'm firing him." "Well, you better be quick about it. He picked the traps up yesterday, and he's using chicken carcasses for bait."
"Won't work," Robert said. "They're too smart. Even the faintest whiff of humans, a coyote, won't come anywhere close."
Nora snatched her bag and got up. "I'm going out to the car. You want to talk about this shit? You can do it without me."
On the way home, Channing made an attempt to jolly her out of her mood.
"It was a joke," he said.
"There's nothing funny about suffering."
"What's wrong with you?"
"Jesus, Channing, nothing's wrong. Coyotes were here long before we were. We're the ones encroaching on their territory, not the other way around. Why don't you just leave them in peace?"
"So now you're an environmentalist?"
"Don't be snide. It's unbecoming."
"Well, you don't have to sound so fucking righteous. I mean, give me a break."
"Don't push it off on me."
"Fine. I'm just telling you the Hellers were offended you made such a scene."
She leaned her head back against the seat.
"Who cares about them?"
"What do you care about?"
"I've lost track."
They made love that night, which was strange given the strain between them. She initiated the sex, fueled by fury and despair. The reality of chatting with Thelma was like a dark aphrodisiac. If the woman was competition, then let her compete with this. She straddled him, pounding away as though riding him until the pleasure peaked between them, harsh and raw. He flipped her over on her back, dragging her to the edge of the bed and lifting her hips while he drove into her again, his legs braced. There was a barely suppressed violence in the encounter, something savage in the way they went at each other.
and if what she felt wasn't love, at least it was a feeling of some kind, intense and immediate. Afterward, they lay together, winded, and when he turned his head and looked at her, she knew he was present. In his face, she could see the Channing she'd loved once upon a time. The Channing who'd loved her even while her heart was broken and she was half dead, emotion drained out of her, leaving only dust. She felt tears welling, and she turned over onto her side so he couldn't see her face. She might have regained her composure if he hadn't seemed so kind. He said, "Are you okay?" She shook her head. She turned onto her back and covered her eyes, feeling the tears seep into her hair. There was no holding back. She felt herself dissolve, and she wept as she had as a child, when pain and disappointment were at their sharpest. She wept as she had as an adult, when she'd been dealt a blow so bitter there was no coming back. She allowed him to comfort her, which she hadn't done in months. She remembered how sweet he'd been and how patient. "Oh, God, it all seems so hopeless," she said. She tucked the sheet under her arms and pulled herself up in a sitting position, her arms wrapped around her knees. "Not so, not hopeless at all." He stroked her hair, which was tangled and wet from tears and from the sweat of their lovemaking. She reached over to snatch a tissue from the bed table and blew her nose. "Don't look at me. I'm hideous. My face is all swollen and my eyes feel like ping-pong balls." His smile was lazy in the half-light shining in from the street. "Where have you been? I've missed you." "I know I've been distant. But sometimes I can't help myself. It's just so much easier to zone out and shut down. But you always come back to me. I look up and there you are," he said. "Come here." He opened his arms and she stretched out beside him, tucked into the crook of his shoulder. He was a spare man, narrow through the chest, and his skin felt 2 degrees cooler than hers. He smelled of sex and sweat and something sweet. She spoke into the hollow of his throat. "What about you, Channing? Where have you been?" "No place important. Go to sleep." Chapter 19. Saturday morning, 6 a.m., I was back at my post. I'd managed 4 hours of sleep, after which I showered, dressed, and headed to the Upper East Side of town. En route, I stopped at McDonald's and picked up a large coffee, an orange juice, and an Egg McMuffin. Before long, the coffee and O.J. would send me in search of a public restroom, but I had to risk it for the moment. In times past, during surveillance work, I've used a tennis ball can for urinary emergencies. This was unsatisfactory. For women, strategy is problematic when it comes to body functions. Aim and positioning are more art than science, and I've been wondering, of late, if a Rubbermaid food container wouldn't be superior. Wide mouth with an airtight lid. I was still running the pros and cons on the notion. When I pulled around the corner onto Juniper Lane, I parked on the same side of the street as the Prestwick's mock Tudor house. I stationed myself 50 feet away from the driveway, which kept me just outside their visual range. Or such was my hope. It was still dark out, and as I settled in to wait, I saw headlights swing around the corner from Santa Teresa Street. A car approached, moving at a crawl. I slouched down on my spine, peering out at the street under the lower edge of the screen. Even with the screen in place, I knew I'd be visible if someone passing turned to look directly at me. I saw a newspaper fly out of the car window. I heard a thwop when it landed, and then the car moved on. At the second house down, a second paper sailed out and into the yard. When the driver turned the corner at the end of the block, I got out and scurried around the side of the green stucco house. I plucked a plastic-wrapped newspaper from the steps and scurried back. In the car again, I removed the plastic sleeve and placed it on the passenger seat beside my camera and my clipboard. I made a note of the time in the interest of record keeping. There was no real imperative for me to do so. In theory, I was working off the hours Marvin had paid for, but he told me I could use the time any way that suited me without accounting to him. At this point, I was in it for the pleasure of the game, though I couldn't afford to do so indefinitely. I had a business to run and bills to pay, matters I wasn't at liberty to ignore. When it was light out, I read the paper, occasionally peering through the holes Henry'd cut in the screen. Not that there was anything to see. I searched for a Diana Alvarez byline, but she'd apparently fired off her best shot. There were already 6 letters to the editor commenting on the subject of the proposed suicide barrier, half in favor and half against. Everybody was indignant about the opinions and points of view that didn't line up with their own. For the next 3 hours, I watched the neighborhood come to life. A jogger trotted into view on Santa Teresa Street, moving left to right. 3 women walked their dogs, moving in the opposite direction. 2 guys bicycled past in skin-tight bicycle shorts and what were surely shaved legs. It served no purpose to think about how bored I was. I went through my index cards, which I'd just about memorized. Surveillance is not for the faint-hearted or for those dependent on external stimulation. For a brief period, I filled in what I could of the crossword puzzle in the local paper, a version Henry disdains as too simple-minded. He likes thorny puzzles based on common sayings spelled backward, or puzzles where all the answers have a tricky common link. Birds of a feather, for instance, or famous last words. I got stuck on 2 down. Patron deity of Ur. What kind of person knows shit like that? It made me feel dumb and uninformed. Idly, I registered a shriek of metal on metal, and when I looked up, I realized the Prestwick's front gate was sliding open. The black Mercedes eased out of the driveway and into the street. I squinted through the hole in the cardboard screen and caught a flash of blonde as the driver turned right. Mother or daughter, I wasn't sure which. As she slowed at the corner and took a second right onto Santa Teresa Street, I turned the key in the ignition. I snatched the screen off the windshield and tossed it over the seat. I headed after her at a modest rate of speed, hoping not to call attention to myself. At the corner, I nosed the station wagon forward and caught the dull red glow of 2 taillights a block down on my right. She reached the T at Orchard Road and stopped for 2 cars that were speeding around the bend. She turned left towards State Street. I gunned it to the end of the block and took the same left she made. She turned left towards State Street. I gunned it to the end of the block and took the same left she had. The Mercedes waited at the 4-way stop, allowing cross traffic to pass. She turned right. I goosed it again and reached the 4-way stop moments after she had. I turned right, straining for sight of her. This end of State Street became livelier as it bore west. After a string of apartment buildings and condominiums, the area was given over to small storefront businesses. At the next light, a supermarket on the left anchored a strip mall that didn't have much else to recommend it. In another 3 blocks, I'd passed down the hatch, where I had met Marvin 3 nights before. I expected the Mercedes to keep moving, but her left-hand turn signal began to blink. When the light changed, she turned onto the side street that bordered the supermarket parking lot. Commercial establishments in this part of town seem to go from grand opening to liquidation sale, everything must go, without much in between. I kept well back as I followed her into the parking lot. She proceeded to the far aisle and came to a stop in front of a large metal donation bin, painted white with an oversized heart outlined in red. The lid of her Mercedes trunk popped up. I reached for my camera, focused, and started clicking off pictures. I captured her image as she got out and left the car idling while she went around to the rear. I was happy to note this was Georgia and not her daughter. She hauled out 2 bulging black plastic garbage bags and dumped them in the bin.
She must have done a closet cleaning, which I was due for myself. She slid back under the steering wheel and circled the parking lot until she found a spot. She went into the supermarket without a backward glance. I set my camera aside. I didn't believe her actions were crime-related. But it's good to be alert, and even better to keep in practice. I found a parking spot to